Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 25th of August. This hour of the program, Michael Brown's funeral is today for most of our all things political discussion, the two very different worlds of Ferguson and why the fires in Ferguson won't end soon, according to our guest. We'll examine racial progress, the black and white views of police conduct toward the Ferguson protesters, the president ordering a complete and comprehensive review of the government's strategy of outfitting local police departments with military-grade body armor, mine-resistant trucks, and automatic rifles. And what we will be taking with us from the death, the protests, and the spotlight on this town. Our guest this hour has been with us many times before, and he spent last week and the week before in Ferguson. Jamel Bowie is with us. Jamel is the Slate staff writer who covers politics, policy, and race, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter. You can find us at K Dunn Show. Jamel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It was a very moving ceremony this morning with so many people there. And I guess the first question, you were there for a couple weeks. What do we all take away from this? Do we finally have another conversation on race and police and all of those issues we've talked about time and time again, but with so much attention, does it move to another level?
I would hope that it moves to another level. I think what Ferguson shows is the extent to which all of these things are not abstractions, that they are very concrete. You look at sort of the patterns of housing in Ferguson and St. Louis area, and you see the consequences of a half century of redlining and other discriminatory housing policies. You look at the composition of the police forces and the political sort of establishment in Ferguson and St. Louis County, and you again see sort of the consequences of a lack of opportunity, of disadvantage, of public policy designed to sort of create both those things. All of these things are tied together, and all of the things that writers like myself and others write about are very, again, very concrete and apparent in what's happening in Ferguson. So I hope going forward, I hope people who want to be engaged in these conversations can see that these aren't abstractions, that the discriminatory policing that we talk about is a real thing, and it happens not just in places like New York, but in small towns and cities across the country.
You've done some exceptional writing from Ferguson, Why the Fires in Ferguson Won't End Soon, one of your articles. And you talk about, and you did this, you talk to all kinds of people in Ferguson, and if you talk to anyone, you say you'll hear a story about the police. Everyone, or at least every black person, can recall an incident.
Right. I spoke to a lot of people while I was there, and one of the first questions I would ask is, what has been your, what kind of interactions and encounters you've had with the police? And often people could attest to being stopped on a regular basis and can attest to either something happening to them or someone they knew or were related to. And the thing I think it's important to emphasize is that just the experience of being stopped on a regular basis, I think, constitutes a radical difference in how some communities are treated by the police and others are. If you are in a, and I should say, many of these neighborhoods, since they're middle income, they're working class neighborhoods, we would not call these poor places. So if you were in a working class or middle income white neighborhood in most places in the country, you have very little contact with the police. You maybe see a police officer, a couple times a month. Typically, the police are coming to your neighborhood when you call them, and they leave when they are finished. And rarely are they stopping you or your family members or your friends. In some of the neighborhoods in Ferguson and the greater St. Louis County, there are police cars constantly around the working class and middle class black neighborhoods, and residents are constantly being stopped by the police 3, 4, 5, 6 times a month. which, you know, even if there were no racial discrimination at hand, would just lead to bad encounters on occasion. And as it stands, the police departments in this area have a history of misconduct. The police department in Jennings, Missouri, which is a neighbor of Ferguson, was disbanded over its police misconduct and racial discrimination. So when you add sort of the unusual amount of contact between these communities and the police, plus racial discrimination, you just have to expect there's going to be problems.
One of the articles of many, there are so many articles I was reading this morning, talked about Ferguson's black majority bearing some responsibility for its lack of representation on the police force and in local government. They cited in the last municipal election, only 6% of African Americans voted. The turnout for whites wasn't great either. It was 17%. In 2012, a majority of the black residents turned out to vote for Mr. Obama, the same proportion as white ones. Would a civic engagement on the part of Ferguson's citizens change this? And can you explain why engagement, at least in the voting process, is not very vigorous?
So I think more civic engagement would change this. I will say that part of the problem in St. Louis County, because notably the city of St. Louis, which has sort of roughly the same demographic composition as many of the municipalities, and is in fact, you know, poorer than many of the municipalities, does not have this problem. I think the issue in Ferguson and its neighbors is that, or one of the issues, is that elections are held on off years in the spring. And so you can see sort of the effect this has on turnout in the stats. In the 2012 presidential election, Ferguson residents and African-American Ferguson residents turned out around 56-57%. In the municipal elections the following spring, that turnout dropped to 6%. Mm. And this is sort of a common phenomena when it comes to municipal elections in mm-hmm. general, right? Like anywhere you go, fewer people are voting for city council or for mayor than they are for president or senate or their house rep. And when you move, and that's even when the elections are in November, when you move those to the spring, when people are working, when there isn't very much, when politics just really isn't in the air the way it is in the fall, it's no real surprise that there are fewer people voting. And so, you know, I think one of the first tasks of people in Ferguson and its neighbors is to sort of work to turn people out, to register voters, and to sort of adjust the schedule of elections so that it's more natural with how people, you know, experience politics. But, you know, outside of those procedural changes, I think it's very much the case that that more civic engagement can at least, you know, begin to remedy some of the complaints, like an unrepresentative police department,
right,
an unrepresentative city council.
And it's hard to believe that with all that this community has gone through and with all of the national spotlight, that there wouldn't be some change in voting patterns, that there wouldn't be a whole group of people who are just much more involved in the political process.
Right. And I think we can definitely expect to see more political engagement. I mean, I talked to quite a few local activists and then local leaders who said that, you know, the next step for this is to begin to turn the energy from the protests, the energy from around the shooting of Mike Brown, into energy to begin to change the political dynamics of Ferguson and its neighbors.
Once again, and you make mention of this in one of your pieces from Ferguson, Pew asked the question, is the issue of race getting more attention in this case than it deserves? And the difference here between white and black response to this is once again pretty phenomenal, as it was in the Trayvon Martin case as well. Can you give us your thoughts on why there is such a difference in response?
Sure. You know, I think there's a couple things going on here. So when it comes to perceptions of the police and whether those are being unfairly or fairly racialized, like I said earlier, I think it has a lot to do with just the kind of neighborhoods people live in. For African Americans, police misconduct by police misconduct is just a part of their lives in a way that isn't true of white Americans, and so that leads to a split in experience, and that's compounded by the fact that the large majority of white Americans don't have black people in their social networks. There is a survey from the Public Religion Research Institute which found that 75% of whites have entirely white personal networks, and that includes you know, friends, family, you know, people you met over dinner, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, many people work with African Americans and people of other races, but working with someone isn't the same as them being a part of your life. And so when social networks are essentially segregated, white Americans just aren't talking to people who might have a different experience of the world than they do. I think another thing, and something that's less quantifiable, but I think it's very real, is the extent to which, you know, part of, if there's a luxury in being a white American, regardless of where you are on the income scale, it is you can often hold the illusion that the past is fundamentally disconnected from your experience. So if someone says something to the effect of, you know, whites get unfair advantages in contemporary society, you can respond by saying, I didn't do anything. I am not responsible for any of these things in the past, because you're not treated as part of a group as much as you are treated as an individual. Black Americans don't have that luxury, you know. Black Americans are subject to perceptions, negative perceptions, based solely on their blackness, and they are tied to a past of discrimination solely based on their blackness. And so they have an experience of working through the world and going through the world that is very different than white Americans. They both think of themselves as individuals and as black people subject to this historical legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think, a very fundamental disconnect. It's a little hard to explain. I mean, I'm having a little trouble trying to explain it right now. But it's real.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you see it in these sorts of survey results.
Yeah. Did you see many demonstrations in support of Officer Wilson? I know that people have been able to raise a huge amount of money, more money, I believe, than Michael Brown's family has raised to support the officer.
I did not attend any of the demonstrations for Officer Wilson, in part because by the time they happened on the days that I had left, so I kind of just narrowly missed them. But you know, several reporters have, and they're there. They're not particularly large. Usually, there are a couple dozen people, maybe 60 or 70 at the most. But the chief complaint I gather from the demonstrators in support of Officer Wilson is that Officer Wilson has been railroaded, or that he has been unfairly maligned. Which, you know, just looking at the progression of the protests, I'm not sure is accurate. The initial protests weren't accusing the police department of being racist. They weren't calling for Officer Wilson to be thrown in the jail. The initial protests were over two things. The first is anger over the fact that Michael Brown's body was left on the street for 4 hours.
Yeah.
And over the fact that the police department was being extremely not forthcoming about information. And so, you know, community members had no idea why Brown's body was left there. They had no idea who was investigating. They had no idea if there was an investigation. They had no idea who the shooter was. Darren Wilson's name wasn't released until almost a week later. They had essentially no information of what happened. And that's what sparked the protest, and arguably we wouldn't have an investigation if these protests hadn't happened. On one hand, I kind of see where supporters of Wilson are coming from, but on the other, you know, this isn't no one, at no point has anyone called for Wilson to be, you know, unfairly arrested or unfairly put on trial. The only thing they've called for is an accounting of what happened and criminal charges, if criminal charges are justified.
Yeah. And the other thing that we all saw was the unbelievable response on the part of this police department. It was, you know, these weapons, these military weapons being pointed to people in the crowd, the incredible amounts of tear gas, way, way over the top. You saw those.
Yes. And it was striking to see how much they were way over the top. And it began from the very beginning. The first sort of demonstration happened the Saturday Brown was killed, and it was just of neighbors sort of like holding what was essentially a vigil around the site where he was killed, and police came with weapons and dogs. The next day, there were further demonstrations on the street right by where he was killed, and again, police came with weapons and dogs and, you know, armored vehicles. And, you know, critics will say, well, you know, they were looting, they were rioting, but the looting, the night of looting, which is the first Sunday night after Mike Brown was killed, only started after this very draconian police response. And to me, you know, if I were there and I were protesting peacefully, and the police responded with armored vehicles and military weapons, I would be agitated,
mm-hmm.
and I'm already angry. And, you know, some sort of looting is bad, but the looting is, you know, is based out of an anger and comes out of sort of this frustration and agitation, which was facilitated by the police. The looting is as much about the police behavior as it was the behavior of some of the protesters. So, you know, the point is just that the heavy-handed police response predated any bad behavior on part of the protesters, and in fact facilitated it by kind of agitating people. And I saw it on the ground that protests would go from being very peaceful and very calm to agitated and more aggressive as soon as the armored vehicles came out. Because how else? Will you react when you see snipers pointing guns at you? I mean, it's just sort of a natural human reaction to get agitated.
Yeah. Jamel Bowie is our guest this hour for All Things Political. We're devoting the hour on this day that Michael Brown's funeral has taken place to what Ferguson, the issues that it has brought forward. As you know, President Obama has now ordered a comprehensive review of the government's strategy of sending local police departments this military-grade body armor, the automatic rifles, the trucks, mine-resistant trucks. Do communities all over the country need such equipment? Do they have training to use it appropriately? That's one of the things that's happened. The racial divide in this country is not as easy to take on, but how do we take it on? Jamel Bowie is our guest. He's been here many times before, staff writer for Slate.com. He has written excellent articles from Ferguson for the last 2 weeks. He covers politics, policy, and race for Slate. We're welcoming your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. How do we proceed from here? Is this a moment where we can list the concerns that we have and we can move forward when it comes to racial progress in this country? But what do we need to address? We welcome your phone calls and we'll start taking them momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We begin our phone calls for Jamel with John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. There's probably both sides of the controversy are probably partially wrong, but I heard on a computer that that Michael Brown's body was laying in the street for 4 hours after he was killed, and I was wondering if your guest would be able to verify it or deny it.
Jamel?
That's true. that's what happened. Residents witnessed it. There are videos of this happening. The police department has acknowledged that this happened. It is absolutely true that Michael Brown's body was on the street for 4 hours.
You have to wonder how anybody could, I mean, just the humanity of that, to say nothing of what preceded it, but what a horrible thing to do, to leave somebody bleeding dead in the street for 4 hours. I mean, it's beyond comprehension.
And I think, you know, it is beyond comprehension, and I think the sort of the inhumanity of it is what spurred the anger.
Yes.
I am having talked to a lot of people, and a lot of, especially a lot of young people who I think have been sort of unfairly maligned as like agitators, but most of them are not. But I am 100% certain, having talked to people, that had the Ferguson Police Department and St. Louis County promptly removed the body as is procedure, and, you know, that evening of the shooting held a press conference in the neighborhood saying, A, this is what happened. B, we have an officer, we have an incident report that we're going to release. And C, here's the name of the officer involved. And then promise to work with the community to investigate this. None of what happened afterwards would have happened. Had the Ferguson Police Department essentially taken the basic steps of public relations, we would be looking at a very different situation.
Hmm. Thanks, John. Jim in Green Bay. Hi. Jim, are you there?
Oh, hello?
Yes, go ahead, Jim.
Oh, I'm sorry. My cell phone is not working real well. My question or my problem is this. You know, there's a lot of stuff you see coming on Fox News about Michael Brown had, you know, the autopsy report showed that he had marijuana in his system. That the officer was badly beaten and actually had a severely damaged eye socket by Michael Brown. But here's the strange thing. The county coroner has yet to release the official autopsy report. The only autopsy report we have right now is that was done by the medical examiner hired by the family. The incident report, which the officer is required by virtue of his job to fill out immediately, wasn't filled out until 10 days after the incident, and the Rachel Maddow Show got a got a copy of the incident report, and it says absolutely nothing. It's just name, date, and location. And there is some speculation that the reason for that is the officer has been informed by his attorney not to say anything further for fear of incriminating himself. I'd like the guest to comment on that.
Thank you, Jim.
So, most of what you said is right. I'll say that there are rumors that Wilson or that Michael Brown fractured Darren Wilson's eye socket. Those are actually unconfirmed. As of my understanding, there is no confirmation that Wilson suffered any serious injuries in his interaction with Brown, that at most he was taken to the hospital after the shooting. He had x-rays that came back negative of any fractures, and he was treated for a swollen face. So, you know, that there was marijuana in Brown's system, I believe, according to the toxicology report, but Officer Wilson was not seriously injured in the altercation. But yeah, no, the Ferguson Police Department did not release a complete incident report. When you look at the sequence of events from responding to the initial protests with a very heavy hand, to refusing to release any information, to releasing incomplete information, or in the case of not this previous Friday, but the Friday before, releasing a video of a robbery involving Michael Brown that did not have anything to do with the shooting, and it later was revealed, or it later came out, that if you looked at the full video, Brown had actually paid for some of his items. When you sort of look at all of that, what it seems like is that the Ferguson Police Department was trying to avoid scrutiny and trying to find a way to, like, put a lid on all of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to find out what the truth is, that's for sure. I'd like for you to comment, and I know you did in letters, op-ed pieces. Yesterday, there was a New York Times International New York Times piece, Michael Brown spent last week grappling with problems and promise. Most of the article is, a fair thing about who he was. It did say that he did not have a criminal record as an adult. His family said he never got in trouble with the law as a juvenile either. This hint of marijuana, listening to rap music, it went on to sort of paint this picture that some would think, oh, this is a bad guy. But I thought your comment today was interesting when you said, you know, the description of smoking weed every now and then and alcohol and listening to rap music. Is probably true of what percentage of the white high school students he went to school with?
I mean, I would say most of them, or at least a very large chunk. I mean, what the Times described with regards to Michael Brown was just a typical teenager. I mean, I went to a mostly white high school. I went to the University of Virginia for college, which is a largely white college. I can't actually count the number of people I encountered and was friends with over, you know, the course of 8 years of schooling that smoked weed, certainly listened to rap music. That's almost banal.
Mm-hmm.
Who shoplifted, who did things that are basically things that teenagers do, which is what's been very odd about a lot of the coverage of Michael Brown, that he's been portrayed as some sort of delinquent, when he is only a delinquent if you assume that other teenagers are, you know, paragons of virtue. But I've yet to meet a teenager that doesn't get into trouble. It's just sort of, it's part of growing up. And the tragedy of Michael Brown and others like him is that the ordinary things of being a teenager are, when they do them, criminalized and seen as, you know, quote, thuggish behavior when it's just being a kid.
Let's go to Kristen in Kenosha. Hi.
Hi. Jim, you had brought up a point earlier about, you know, the looting and when people, if you were there, you would have become agitated too. And with looting and having all the officers there and everything, is that an excuse, though, to go about and steal TVs? And I don't understand. I mean, if I see SWAT people in front of me, my response is not going to say, well, let me go out and steal TVs. I'm going to go inside my house and be safe and comfortable. I don't understand how you got the two together. That's my first point. And secondly, if I may, on August 22nd, just, you know, this week, there was a gentleman in Utah, a 22-year-old man, white, who was shot by a black officer. The gentleman, 22 years old, was also unarmed. Where's his story?
So I'll just answer those questions in order. So it's not excuse making to say that when your peaceful protest is met with armored vehicles and sniper rifles and shotguns and dogs, that for some portion of that crowd it may agitate them into violence. When I was in Ferguson, I was shooting photos of police officers, and one of those police officers pointed a rifle at me. I will tell you right now that the experience of having a rifle pointed at me made me agitated.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a very calm person. So you can imagine if, a couple young people full of grief over the killing of a friend or a neighbor, trying to express that grief and being met with heavy-handed police artillery, that some of them might decide, you know, if this is how you're going to treat us, then this is how we're going to act. They broke some windows. They looted a convenience store. This image of people carrying TVs from stores is not actually accurate. There was a mobile phone store that was looted, so people did take a few cell phones, but this image of people smashing windows of department stores and stealing TVs is just not accurate. But again, this is not excusing it. I'm not saying looting is okay. Looting is bad. But, you know, I would like to see how a mostly white affluent community would react if it tried to have a public demonstration and the police came with heavy weapons and armored cars and dogs and tear gas and rubber bullets. Something tells me that people in those communities would not just go to their homes meekly. When you respond to people with high provocations, you may get high provocations in return. As for the second question about the young man killed by a black police officer, I think it's important to understand that the anger over the Michael Brown killing isn't just or even exclusively, you know, racial anger. It is my understanding that the young man killed by a black police officer, that young man's body was removed after he was killed shortly thereafter, that police officer is under investigation, that he will be reprimanded, that the procedures we have for dealing with officer-involved shootings are working as designed. The problem of Michael Brown was that at the beginning, this was not clear, that from all accounts, and just looking at the behavior of the Ferguson and St. Louis County police, that those procedures were not being followed. And so the protests are about forcing authorities to follow their procedures. If a black police officer killed a young white man or young white woman, and his department stonewalled and refused to issue information and responded to public protests with armored vehicles and tear gas, I will be the first there to cover it. But to present that as somehow an example of selective outrage on part of people protesting on behalf of the Michael Brown family, I think fundamentally misunderstands what is happening with the Michael Brown situation.
Yeah, and you also have to take into account the way we started this program, that when you tell everybody you had talked to had had some kind of negative encounter with the police. We talked to a journalist last week who said, you know, he'd been pulled over. He was from Ferguson originally and had been pulled over at least 50 times for something as grave as having snow on your license plate when it was snowing outside. That these reports are all over the place. So, of course, there's an entirely different relationship, and you've got years and years of this being pulled over for being African-American. I don't see any other way to see this. And, of course, you're going to be upset by it. I mean, you've got this whole history, right?
Right, exactly. I think you summed it up perfectly. You have this situation that is very unique and very unusual. You have regular police contact and regular police abuse. And so what we're seeing isn't just a response to this one thing. We are seeing a response to the entire atmosphere of police misconduct. I mean, one of the officers on scene in Ferguson is under a civil rights investigation for assaulting and hogtying a 12-year-old boy who is checking his mail. Right? This is the kind of environment that we're dealing with. So, again, to portray these protests as strictly about Michael Brown and as strictly some racial grievance really is misunderstanding what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Alan in Appleton. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I wanted to touch on two things. The first thing was the white guy that was shot in Salt Lake City. Apparently, the police were responding to reports of somebody waving a gun around. And he also did have a criminal record from what I heard, what I've seen on that. And the other thing is, to get to the militarization of police, we're policing in the wrong way. I mean, you cannot have police officers driving around anonymously in police cars. They need to be out policing the citizens that they're responsible for. And the reason why we have so many officers that are bad, I believe, is because the public doesn't really deal with them on a day-to-day basis. They don't know who they are. And until we bring them back and make them known to the community so that people in the community can see how these officers react day-to-day, we have no way of getting rid of the bad ones. Mm. And this is going to be a bad thing forever until we do that. And anybody, no matter what race they are, needs to be worried about their children, because their children are the vulnerable ones nowadays. I have nephews that are early 20s and late teens. They are going to be the ones that are going to take the brunt of the police officers that we have nowadays. And I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jamil.
I completely agree. I mean, part of this story obviously is the militarization of police forces, and this is, this again is a very long term thing. It's been going on for 20 years, and I think we saw in Ferguson a stark example of it. But nationwide, I mean, the ACLU early this year or late last year released a report showing just how often say SWAT forces are used to do routine things like serving warrants, that police departments have picked up a tremendous amount of equipment, and they are using it in ways that aren't just dangerous to ordinary people, but aren't very conducive to policing. I mean, I don't know a single person who would be happier to talk to a police officer for any reason when that person is clad in SWAT gear and has heavy weapons on them.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what you think about the president saying that he would like a comprehensive review of this whole militarization of police departments. It, when you say it's been going on for 20 years, what the heck? Didn't anybody think about whether or not this was a good idea 20 years ago, for heaven's sake?
I mean, I think President Obama is right to want to do a review of this. And, you know, I think it's worth considering the context of police militarization. I mean, it began at a high watermark for violence in American cities. And what sort of happened is at the same time that these programs have continued and that more and more departments have gotten their hands on more and more military hardware, violent crime has taken a dramatic decrease. We're at sort of decades low mm-hmm. for violent crime. And so, you know, the war against violent crime, such as it is over. You know, we solved that problem. And we're solving that problem, and yet we're still giving police departments weaponry designed for an environment that just doesn't exist anymore.
Jamelle Bouie is our guest for All Things Political. He covers politics, policy, and race for Slate.com. He's a very thoughtful, thorough writer. He has spent the last 2 weeks in Ferguson, Missouri, as today is the funeral of Michael Brown. We thought it would be worth our time to spend the whole hour of All Things Political talking about all these issues that have come to our attention once again, a huge racial divide in this country, a divide when it comes to how we view our police departments, a divide when it comes to how we go to school, how we live, and what we do about it. What do we do with this? All of the attention that's been focused on this. Now he will be buried today. What now? So here's how you reach us. One line is open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're talking about Michael Brown this hour with Jamelle Bouie. Our number is 800-486-8655. Steve in Dubuque, hi.
Hi. I have some quite a few questions. One, when the Brown was laying on the ground for 4 hours, was there investigations being done? Were the police taking measurements? You know, were they securing the scene so no evidence was tampered with? That stuff does happen, you know, and it does take a while to do an investigation.
Jamelle.
So initially, the time between the St. Louis County Police coming and other law enforcement officials coming to sort of secure the scene, and the time between that and the shooting was actually a couple hours. So there was a period of several hours where there is police tape, but there were no law enforcement officers. It was just the body.
Yeah, I think I was reading in the New York Times had a story yesterday about this, and members of his family would cross the tape, understandably, to look at their nephew or to look at the member of their family, and they were escorted out of the area by some police officer who happened to be around. But even the family who had heard about this, of course, and wanted to see their relative who was in the street dead were kept out of the area completely as well. I mean, it was just so inhumane across the board.
Right, right. That's there's a video that that someone recorded and that they put on the internet, and you can watch it, and it's neighbors watching in sort of in shock over what's happened, and sort of like, you know, very much trying to process the fact that this young man has been killed and has been left there without anyone to attend to him.
Well, from your conversations with so many people in Ferguson, what was the answer you were receiving as to what Michael Brown was stopped for?
Most people had said that he was stopped for nothing. And witness the one witness report we have from Michael Brown's friend. This is sort of the heart of the disagreement. The Ferguson police say that Brown was stopped just as a matter of for obstructing traffic, which I'll say, if you look at the street where it happened, it's a small, not very traffic street, and so the Brown and his friend are walking in the middle of the street, and you know, I can totally see why they would, because there's no one, very few people drive down the street. Michael Brown's friend says that what happened was the police officer came, told them to get on the sidewalk, and they didn't, and then he doubled back, and that's when the altercation began. But there's no official reason for the stop, and most people I talked to said he was just stopped because that's what happens. You just get stopped walking around.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Steele in Appleton. Hi.
Yes. Hello, everyone. A couple months back, we had a rancher Bundy in Nevada with a bunch of horses and the BLM. And let's just switch white to black. If he was a black guy and all those militiamen that came happened to be mostly of the same race just because they felt offended. And, yes, we have the militarization of cops, and now we have the militarization of militia groups that are going to stand down law enforcement. And what color do you have to be to stand down law enforcement? That's my comment.
Jamel, you want to respond?
I think that's right. When I was watching the Bundy standoff unfold, I couldn't help but wonder how this would be treated if Clive and Bundy were black American. And knowing what we know about police interactions with black Americans, I have to assume that he wouldn't have been able to threaten federal agents with violence and have a militia at his back had he been black American.
And Carol in Menasha. Carol, hello. Carol, are you there?
Yes, I am. I am so angry over this whole situation. It comes down to an unarmed black kid was shot for walking while black. And somebody brought up if the level of police forcing came into an affluent neighborhood, people wouldn't meekly back down. Well, this sort of thing would never happen in an affluent neighborhood. I can't imagine the police in Whitefish Bay shooting down a teenager in the street and having that sort of military equipment. It's outrageous, and it has to stop. I'm a fat, middle-aged white woman, and I know if I get stopped by the cop, I'm not going to get shot. I might get a ticket. I might get a warning. And it's just infuriating me. I took part in the Madison protests in the winter of 2011, and the way the Madison police handled that is how you're supposed to handle peaceful protests. I took pictures of myself with the cops.
Jamel.
I think that's right. Not only would most affluent communities never see this level of policing, and I say that having grown up in a mostly white suburb that did not have that, there weren't even police cars regularly going around the block. It just wasn't my encounters with the police were few and far between. And definitely, if you are police encounters take on a different tone, a different feeling when you are a black American. One of the startling stats to come out of this is that there is an officer-involved shooting with a black American every, I think, 28 hours or so. It's a regular feature of life, and it's you know, it's something that we as a society tolerate, but I don't think we would tolerate it if this were happening to young white teenagers or really anyone else.
Mm-hmm. So what do we need to do now? What do we need to do in terms of, there are just so many darned issues here, separation, segregation, militarization of police, et cetera. I guess the first thing is to find out what the heck happened here, and to have justice prevail. People need to know what the truth is, and it needs to happen in as quickly as possible, as thoroughly as possible, but as quickly as possible, too.
Right. I mean, I think there's so many issues at play here that it's hard to say what should happen. I think for Ferguson and for St. Louis County, I hope that the investigation is thorough, that if Officer Wilson is found to have, been found to behave wrongly, then that there are criminal charges filed. If he is not, then, you know, so it goes. But a full investigation, because I think that's what the Ferguson and St. Louis County owe the Brown family. Beyond that, there's the Department of Justice is conducting its own investigation, and there's a chance, given what we know about sort of the racial disparities in policing in Ferguson, that police department is placed under direct supervision of the federal government. And beyond that, you know, like we talked about earlier, now is the time for political organizing, for finding ways to increase representation of Black Americans in city government and in county government. And it's a time for cooperation. I mean, there is real racial suspicion in this area. There are real racial tensions. And I think for anything to move forward and for anything to move forward in a constructive way, those need to dissipate. And that requires leaders on all sides interacting with each other and looking for ways to improve conditions for everyone in the St. Louis area.
Time for one more call. Pete in Marinette. Hi.
Hey, how you doing? My name is Pete from Marinette.
Hi, Pete.
You know, I believe life is a learning process. I mean, hindsight is 20/20. I hope we all learn something about this. I hopefully rules of engagement are, and everybody's properly trained and everything. But, you know, things happen. And when they happen, you can't take them back. What can we learn about this? I mean, what's our next step?
Things happen. Well, we certainly have to find out why things like this happen, right, Jamel?
Right, we do. And I guess my only thing I'd say to things happen is that what makes people upset is that these things always seem to happen to a certain kind of person, and that it seems like every year we have a new name to add to the list. This year it's Michael Brown. Last year it was Jordan Davis. Last year it was Trayvon Martin, and so on and so forth. So I think people want these things to not just happen anymore.
Yeah, I think you're right. Are you going back to Ferguson, sir?
Not anytime soon, but we'll see what happens when the grand jury releases its results in October, and then there's a chance I'll go back next year just to see what things are looking like a year out.
And is it time for the president, as he can do this, as nobody else can, to give a national address on all of these issues we've talked about?
I'm conflicted on this one, because I think that for as much as it might be useful, it also might be terribly counterproductive. The president still has things to get done, and wading into these things might polarize the electorate even more than it already is.
Jamel, thank you so much for being with us again. Thanks for all of your writing on this. It's so good. Thanks.
Thank you.
Jamel Bowie, Slate staff writer. He covers politics, policy, and race. And he's been there for 2 weeks, and so he's written a lot of very thorough and very moving and informative pieces. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return and have a little bit of fun and be serious also talking about baseball.